no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
They're taking on the lessons, fully into it, trying to learn everything that they can to take away, to go back to then fight back on the front lines.
3 years ago, Russia launched its devastating full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Since then, NATO allies have been steadfast in supporting the Ukrainian armed forces with the weapons and training they need to defend their homeland. Together, they're helping forge the next generation of Ukrainian soldiers called upon to defend their country.
That's an official NATO video released this year, highlighting the alliance's firm and unwavering support for an embattled Ukraine fighting Russian aggression. Firm and unwavering, that is, until last week, when President Trump, together with his senior officials, fractured that alliance, opening up talks with the Russians, deriding Ukrainian President Zelensky as an unpopular dictator, and throwing into doubt America's commitment to a mutual defense treaty that has been a cornerstone of the nation's foreign policy since the end of World War II. What is the future of NATO under a U.S. administration that seems to have no interest in standing by a treaty that has been sacred writ from multiple presidents for more than 70 years? And what about Article 5, the key provision that commits all NATO countries to come to the defense of any one of them that might be attacked? Can anyone count on President Donald Trump honoring it? We'll talk to a former U.S. ambassador to NATO, retired Lieutenant General Doug Lute, on this episode of Spy Talk. Ambassador Doug Lute, welcome to Spy Talk.
Good to be with you.
So no shortage of stuff to talk about. I reached out last week because among your many accomplishments in life, you were the ambassador to NATO, and I wanted to have a NATO expert talk about the upending of the seeming upending of American foreign policy last week as it regards to NATO, Ukraine, Russia. But before we get to all that, before you were ambassador to NATO, you were director of operations at the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Pentagon. So Friday night, President Trump fired the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the chief of naval operations, the Air Force vice chairman, and top military lawyers for the Army, Navy, and Air Force. As somebody who is steeped in that world, what was your reaction to the Friday night purge, and what impact is that going to have on military operations around the world?
So I don't think, Mike, any immediate impact. It's the downstream effects that I worry about. So first of all, this is an unprecedented move. While there have been senior military officers removed from position over history, there's always been, in each of those previous cases, a proximate cause for the removal and replacement of a senior military officer. And that doesn't appear to be the case here. So I worry about that. I worry that this is a huge exception to the law, which specifies that the chairman be drawn from among the sitting service chiefs, so Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and the serving combatant commanders, so the four-star joint commanders around the world. And of course, with the selection of CQ Brown's successor, he doesn't fill any of that. in terms of qualifications, and he doesn't really have the experience specified in the law in terms of executing an exception to policy. So it's a curious move to replace without proximate cause, and it's also an excursion from the law in terms of his named replacement. And then, you know, I think getting too little notice is that among these dismissals were the three service chiefs, so Army, Navy, Air Force, judge advocate generals. And these are the senior, typically three-star lawyers that serve in each of these military departments. And of course, eventually in the orders process, the legal assessment of lawful versus unlawful orders rests with these senior lawyers. And they've been replaced as well. So this is unprecedented, and I think damaging in the near term. The downstream effect that I mentioned is that I'm concerned that this presses senior military promotions and assignments, like to the chairman or like to one of these legal offices. It presses these appointments through a partisan political filter, which will have a chilling effect on those who are not yet in those positions, but may someday aspire to be in those positions. And I'm concerned that we're building a military based more on loyalty to the current president than on competence and the oath of office, which, of course, is to the Constitution, not to the president.
That seems to be the theme in departments across the board in the government. Look at the FBI and the Justice Department, right, most prominently.
So, I mean, in this way, the DOD is just joining the others, but in a very prominent way, and in a disturbing way.
Yeah. I mean, you say no proximate cause, but I mean, there was a loose proximate cause, and that is Secretary Hegseth's war on wokeism. And I guess General Brown was black. The chief of naval operations was a woman. This seems to be sending a message of some kind. What is that message?
Well, I mean, you know, C.Q. Brown was nominated and confirmed as the Air Force Chief of Staff under Donald Trump in his first administration. Right. So, I mean, he was black when he was confirmed then, and he's an African-American today. So I don't think it's that. If anything, I suppose that in the Black Lives Matter period several years ago, C.Q. Brown spoke to as the Air Force chief, spoke to his servicemen and women about his personal experience as a young African-American officer making his way up the ranks and from second lieutenant to four-star general. And if you haven't seen this, or your listeners haven't seen this video, it's on YouTube, right? It's actually quite moving. And I think most military officers that I know would applaud what Brown did by way of this video, and sort of relating to even the junior most military service members, that he too had gone through some challenges on his way up the chain. So if anything, that seems to be the proximate cause, but come on, that could be equally attributed to good leadership. It certainly doesn't say anything about incompetence or malfeasance or poor judgment or anything like that. So I don't buy the proximate cause argument, except that it looks like partisan politics.
Right. All right. Let's get to the meat of it. So much I want to ask you about, but I got to start out with we're taping this on Tuesday, February 25th, and the lead story in the Washington Post has a lead that I can't imagine I would have ever read before. And let me just read it to you and get your reaction. The United States voted with Russia, North Korea, Iran, and 14 other Moscow-friendly countries Monday against a UN resolution condemning Russian aggression in Ukraine and calling for the return of Ukrainian territory. The resolution, sponsored by representatives from Kyiv, passed overwhelmingly in the UN General Assembly.
Well, I think it'll stand as an historic headline because it is the first time, at least since World War II, I suppose, that and since the founding of the UN in 45, that you've seen this kind of voting pattern in opposition and blatant opposition to our longstanding alliances and our longstanding principle base activity in the UN. So there's no question. But look, Mike, there's a lot of change going on here. In fact, you can argue that the last election was all about change, right? And Americans voted for change, and now we're getting it, okay? And we're getting it nationally by way of things like this UN vote, things like the assault on USAID, things like mass layoffs, budget incursions by people who don't really have executive authority and all that, right? So we're getting rapid fire change on the national scene. The backdrop to this, though, and I think the backdrop to Trump's being in office for a second time is global change. And the global shift that's underway is that after about 25 years of unipolarism, right? In other words, the U.S. essential, U.S. and its allies dominated the global power structure, the global scene, right? As one pole. We now see very dramatically and very clearly a shift to an alternative, a transition to a multipolar system. And clearly, most important here, I think, is the rise of China, which was not a pole 25 years ago. But you see other dynamics as well. You see Russia, you see Putin essentially saying, hey, what about me? What about Russia? Shouldn't Russia be respected as a major global power? In a sense, he's saying, shouldn't Russia be a pole in this new multipolar system? And then you see the split, the 75-year split between the U.S. and its Western European allies and the distancing between Trump and our European allies. And Europe's left asking itself, what about us? Should Europe be a pole independent of the United States? And you see this played out in Munich and the Munich Security Conference 10 days ago.
You see, yeah, you were there last week.
I was there.
It was a dizzying week for anybody who's been active in the Atlantic Alliance for decades the way you have.
Right. And just yesterday, you see it played out with the Macron visit. And later this week, we'll have Stormer from the UK visiting. So this shift, this massive sort of tectonic shift is happening. And a lot of what we're reading day to day in the newspapers reflects this transition.
What was it like being at Munich last week? The speech by Vice President Vance, this extraordinary speech where he lambasts European democracies for not being more tolerant of right-wing extremist groups like the AfD in Germany, President Trump from afar calling Zelensky a dictator with, 4% approval rating, something that was complete nonsense. I mean, you were speaking to our erstwhile European allies. What was the reaction?
Well, the vice president's speech was, in my view, off in terms of both substance and tone. Substantively, rather than talking about this most significant challenge to transatlantic security today being the aggression of Russia in Ukraine, He turned to the greatest threat to European security is from within, the political dynamics within. And this is these are things like, as he mentioned, rule of law, freedom of the press, listening to voters, outside interference in elections and so forth. So substantively, what struck me and many of my European friends and former colleagues was that, wait a second. How can this vice president be lecturing anybody on those matters? I mean, you know, if you just focus on rule of law, how does January 6th look against a standard of rule of law? How does freedom of speech stand against barring particular press outlets because of the name they assigned to the Gulf between Florida and Mexico, right? Is it Gulf of America? The Gulf of, I mean, come on. This doesn't ring right. And in terms of external influence on elections, after the speech, Vance met with one political party on the way to the airport out of Munich, right? He met with the far-right German AfD 1 week before the German elections.
Which no German political party will have anything to do with.
Right. Even before the elections, the other German parties declared that they would never form a coalition with the AfD. They essentially froze out the AfD, right? Okay, so on all substantive counts, he was off. But even more stark, Mike, was his tone. It was condescending, lecturing, almost scolding. And it got the response from our European allies that you would expect, which was cold, bewildered, first of all, but then a sort of a cold, not even lukewarm response. And, you know, this is surprising because the day before he gave the speech, Vance and his wife visited and laid a memorial at the Dachau site, which is just on the outskirts of Munich, right? So the concentration camp memorial just on the outskirts of Munich. And I thought to myself, you know, this is a brilliant move. Because he goes to see Dachau. Now, the next day in his speech, it's the perfect opening for, you know, yesterday I was reminded at Dachau of the last time Europe was dominated by a dictator. And today I'm here to talk to you about today's attempt to dominate by way of a dictator, meaning Putin, right? And of course, he didn't go there at all. So I don't know how he even in his own mind connects what he did one day to the next.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of speeches at Munich Security Conference, I don't know if you were there, whether it was 2007 or 2008, when Putin gave his famous speech in 2007. And
he laid out the campaign plan,
you know, criticizing the United States for its unipolar dominance of the world and making it clear that Russia was not going to go along with a U.S.-led.
Right. That was really the shot across the bow. So Munich 2007, the speech by Putin, that essentially it laid out his campaign plan. It said, we're not putting up with this. And that's when he essentially declared the campaign that began within a year with the invasion of Georgia, right? Several years after that, 2014, the seizing of Crimea, destabilizing of the Donbass. And then, of course, after that, in 22, now just three years ago, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So one thing about Putin, he doesn't hide his intentions. I mean, he's pretty clear about where he's going.
So is the Vance speech sort of, you know, the touchstone to Putin's speech? Or, you know, have we come full circle here?
So after the speech in Munich last week, that was the conversation that you had. In fact, some go all the way back before the Munich Security Conference and say, you know, there are three data points here in Munich, modern Munich history. Munich, 1938, and this and the handoff of the Sudetenland to Hitler, right? Munich, 2007. Putin's on the scene and declares his campaign plan. And then Munich 2025, where the U.S. Essentially breaks with Europe.
Right. Well, interesting historical sweep there. In last December, after the election, you wrote an open letter to then President-elect Trump, that he needed to increase U.S. support for Ukraine. You said the problem with the war in Ukraine was incrementalism by the United States and the West, giving just enough weapons for the Ukrainians to continue to resist Russian aggression, but not enough to win. You called for a increase. It is not too late to do the right thing and give Ukraine what it needs. Fair to say, he didn't take your advice.
Well, look, so I wrote that after the election. It's actually published, I think, after the election last fall. And I was actually writing to my former Obama administration colleagues, then serving in the Biden administration, and critiquing them for this, as you say, this very incremental, step-by-step, too little, too late approach to military assistance to Ukraine. You know, we remember that in the immediate aftermath of the 2022 invasion, we debated for weeks about javelins. Okay, these are shoulder-fired anti-tank systems. Then we debated about artillery. Then we debated about rocket artillery. Then we debated about, you know, on a tanks. And then we debated about allowing others to provide F-16s. The most recent increment in this pattern was the long-range precision strike ground-to-ground missile system, bad acronym, ATACMS, although it's an acronym that actually is somewhat descriptive of the missile, right? But the ATACMS missile. And even when we eventually, years into the program, provided ATACMS to Ukraine, we placed a geographic limit on it. So the short summary of our approach was enough not to lose, but not enough to win. And I made the case that even approaching the three-year mark, if we removed the restrictions and gave Ukraine what they actually need, I think that Ukraine could isolate the occupying Russian army and potentially see it crumble, fracture from within. Why do I say this? And I won't go long on this because paper's out there, right? For two factors. One is, it's a low-grade, low-quality Russian occupying force. They are poorly led, poorly manned, poorly trained, poorly equipped, and they're essentially cannon fodder. Their leadership don't care a whit about their well-being. That's an army that's vulnerable to cracking. Second factor, that low-grade army depends on railroad-based logistics from Mother Russia. Railroads are vulnerable and can be struck and restruck, isolating the Russian occupiers in a way that actually increases the chance that they fracture from within. The most iconic case here is the Kerch Strait Bridge, which is a long rail and road bridge connecting Russia to the Crimea Peninsula, and over which almost all the supplies for Crimea flow. The Kerch Strait Bridge today stands, and Russia continues to use it as a lifeline for its occupation of the Crimea Peninsula. That doesn't make any military sense.
You know, I have to say, there will be a historic debate about the incrementalism critique that you have that you laid out there. But as we are today, look, the counteroffensive by the Ukrainians did not gain ground. The Russians do seem to be advancing. The status quo of the Russians, there does not seem to be at this point a strategic path for the Ukrainians to dislodge the Russians from the Donbass or Crimea. Does it make sense to continue what seems like a war of attrition, especially when, look, Western support is not in perpetuity? We've already seen that with the United States and the Trump era. At this point, do we need to just, are you saying the entire Trump idea of cutting a deal with Putin now is wrong?
Well, who knows, right? Because we're not even into negotiations yet. What I observe is that the incremental approach that we've applied through the Biden years, and apparently that may be the high water mark in terms of U.S. support, given right. what we can expect from the Trump administration, right? But that incremental approach, coupled with at least the rhetorical standing, the rhetorical positions of the Trump administration in its first month or so. So, you know, no NATO membership for Ukraine, no U.S. troops as a part of a ceasefire confirmation force, no return of territory. I mean, if we're going to take those off the table before we even get to the table, then I don't have prospects. I don't have high expectations that we're going to get a deal that is anything beyond a pause and proves to be in the longer term stable and durable. So
what does that mean as a practical matter? Are you saying we'll just get a pause and the Russians will resume a year or two down the road?
So Putin has placed his economy on a war footing, right? So he has renationalized state industries. His expenditure is all in for a win in Ukraine. Putin does not, and he's been explicit about this. Even Lavrov last week in Riyadh was explicit about this. This is not simply about Ukraine. This is about reestablishing a gray zone of buffer states under Russia's thumb that separates Russia from NATO territory. So any short-term deal in Ukraine will simply give Russia time to lick its wounds, mobilize again, take advantage of external support from Iran, North Korea, and China, and continue to pursue its strategic objectives. So we can't be short-sighted here. And I'm concerned that the sorts of time expectations that the Trump administration has mentioned. So remember, I'll solve this in a day, even before the inauguration. Okay, I'll solve it a day after the, and now we're talking about 100 days and so forth. Look, that's not a way to go into a negotiation with Vladimir Putin. By surrendering your incentives, your leverage up front, as I've outlined, and then putting yourself on a timeline. So we're entering negotiations, if they ever come to pass, we're entering them with a weak hand.
I want to take a quick break here and return with Ambassador Lute and discuss the future of NATO. We are back with Ambassador Doug Lute, former U.S. ambassador to NATO, former chief of operations at the Joint Chiefs of Staff, former chief of operations at Central Command, retired lieutenant general. The gist of the U.S. complaint or the Trump complaint about Europe and NATO is that Europe is not spending enough on its collective defense. Does Trump have a point?
Yes, he does. But he has a point only to a point. Let me explain. So it is right, it is true, that not all 32 allies, or 31 setting aside the U.S., are at the stated, agreed goal that they commit 2% of their national economies, 2% of their GDP every year, to their own national defense. In fact, today, only 23 of 32 allies meet the 2% mark. However, when this pledge was taken in 2014, under Barack Obama as president, after the first invasion of Ukraine, well, the next proximate invasion of Ukraine by Russia in 2014, seizing of Crimea and so forth, right? NATO allies in the UK at a NATO summit agreed that they should get to 2% in 10 years. So that was 10 years ago. At that time, when the Obama pledge was signed, only three allies were at 2%. One of them was the US. So now fast forward 10 years, and you have 23 allies, right? If you average, if you take the U.S. out of the equation and average the European allies, on average, they are at 2%. Now, there's still some laggards below.
Right.
And Trump makes a good point about those. Right. But the point is, NATO has made significant history. Here's the reality, Mike. As a former U.S. ambassador under President Obama, I get asked, well, wait a second. Who's most responsible for this? Was it Obama who signed the pledge and brought consensus in 2014? And now we've seen 10 years of progress. Or is it Trump, who when Trump won, basically yelled at allies in public, right? Tried to sort of blame and shame again. Which of these presidents? And, you know, I think the right answer is you got the wrong president. It was Putin who's most responsible for the fact that NATO's seen 10 consecutive years of defense spending among European allies. First with the 2014 invasion of Crimea, seizing of Crimea, and then full scale over the last 3 years, the invasion of Ukraine. So look, we need to focus here. There's no amount of cajoling, embarrassing, shaming by any American president. By the way, this goes back well before Obama as well, right? That's going to cause European politicians to do something that they don't see as in their own interest. Putin convinced them, first in 14 and then in 22, that increased defense spending was necessary and in their own interest. So he's got some facts right, but I don't think he's got the whole story.
The linchpin of collective defense under the NATO treaty has been at Article 5, which says an attack on one NATO country is an attack on all of them. Here's a quote in the paper today from Jim Townsend, former Pentagon official for Europe. Now, can we really trust the United States to honor Article 5? What's the answer?
Under this administration, I can't be sure. And that's a break in 75 years of NATO history. I mean, the treaty that you mentioned is, of course, signed in 1949, right? Europe's in ashes. The last country standing is us. And in 1949, the other 11 treaty members were anxious for U.S. support. And the U.S. was anxious to provide a stable Europe. Why? Because in 1949, under Harry Truman, the U.S. essentially said, we're not doing that again. And by that, he meant we're not doing World War I again, and we're not doing World War II again. We're going to set up something different. And that was NATO, and eventually the European Union. And, you know, beyond the military scope, the World Trade Organization, the IMF, the World Bank, the structures that have the institutions that have served us well since the immediate aftermath of World War II. And so today, as you know, we talked earlier about we're shifting to a multipolar world. If it turns out that the US and Europe are not one pole, but break into two separate poles, then Article 5, which is essentially the glue of the transatlantic relationship, Article 5, I think, is cast in doubt. Now, it doesn't mean that the U.S. would have to leave NATO, because a careful reading of Article 5 says that an attack on one shall be considered as an attack on all. And then one sentence lower in the Article 5, it says, and each member will decide according to its own interests how to respond. So Article 5 is not a trigger to war, unless, in the case of the United States, the U.S. decides to go to war. It could be a trigger for diplomatic action. It could be a trigger for economic sanctions. And you see what I'm saying?
There's right, a whole yeah, range. Yeah. So there is some wiggle room there. But
yes.
Historically, look, when the United States was attacked on 9/11,
right,
and we invaded Afghanistan, our NATO partners were there with us fighting.
No question.
Fact, sending troops.
In 75 years, that's the only activation of Article 5. And the Allies did it on September 12th, 2001, after it was clear that this was an external attack, right? That the attacks by Al-Qaeda were external. And you're also right that that resulted in 20 years of combat operations in Afghanistan at our side, and European allies suffered one-third of the casualties in those 20 years in Afghanistan. So as Americans, a little humility here would be a good thing, right? Right. A little memory that when we needed NATO and we needed Article 5, it was there.
Right. The threat from Putin is sort of traditionally described as, well, if he gets Ukraine, you know, Moldova, and, you know, then maybe Poland, maybe other NATO countries. Although, given the depleted state of Russia's military, it's hard to see that in the immediate future. But at the same time, we have what is sort of euphemistically described as hybrid warfare by the Russians throughout Europe. Assassinations, sabotage, even threats to aircraft, DHL aircraft we've seen. How does the West and the United States, to the extent that we're still invested in European security, resist what we're seeing in pretty brazen actions by Russians that some have said amount to terrorism against Western Europe?
So look, the premise of your question is spot on, and that is that Russia's army, which remember, the army that invaded Ukraine in 2022 was the result of a 10-year investment program by Putin. He tried to change the organization, increase the training, modernize the equipment, and so forth, and it's been destroyed. It's been largely destroyed with some 700,000 or 800,000 casualties in Ukraine. But that does not remove the threat, the Russian threat. He still has air and missile defense forces or air and missile forces that he launches against Ukraine daily. He still has all these sort of sub-Article 5, sub-conventional, unconventional forms of election interference, cutting undersea cables in the Baltic Sea, energy intimidation, although that's much reduced given Europe's move over the last 3 years to reduce its reliance on energy, misinformation, disinformation, cyber attacks, even assassinations that are playing out on a European territory, but frankly, on our territory as well. So this is a very serious threat where Putin can essentially wage war against us without attacking, in conventional terms, without attacking across NATO boundaries. And NATO has taken modest steps to share information about these threats. I mean, the most recent case is sharing information and taking steps to secure the undersea cables in the Baltic Sea, which have been repeatedly attacked. But there's much more NATO should be doing against these hybrid threats. And it should be doing so in cooperation with the EU, because many of the authorities and so forth for internal defense of our NATO allies really rest with European Union authorities. And less so strictly military authorities in NATO. So NATO doesn't, for example, secure election processes.
What worries you the most right now?
I'm worried that the steps that have been taken in the last 30-odd days under this administration will have significant, lasting downstream effects on the ability of our allies to trust us. I think we are eroding 70 plus years of trust in a matter of days. And once what we know, whether it's interpersonal trust or international trust, is that once trust is eroded, it is not easily recovered. And I'm concerned that the most damaging impact here is this assault on trust. And if you can't trust the United States, then what does Article 5 really mean? And I think that's the root of the problem.
On that sobering note, I want to thank you, Ambassador Lute, for a illuminating, if somewhat depressing, conversation, but one that we'll want to continue to have, and hope we'll be able to have you back to continue the discussion. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks very much. Good to be with you.
Sure enough. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai, and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance, or don't understand the differences between insurance plans, or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.